Hello and welcome to Military History Inside Out. In today's episode, I speak with author Phil Paget about his book Advocating Overlord, which came out in April of 2018 from Potomac Books. Mr. Paget has worked in the defense industry for many years, his whole career, and he's retired, and he wrote this book. He had a long-standing interest in a meeting that Churchill and Roosevelt had during World War II, where they discussed both Overlord, which is the D-Day invasion of 1944, the cross-channel invasion by the Allies from the UK to the coast of France, and they also discussed the Manhattan Project, the U.S. Atomic Research Project for the atomic bomb. And his hypothesis is that there was a quid pro quo between Churchill and Roosevelt, that Churchill would agree to Overlord if the British were allowed to be more involved with the Manhattan Project. The British preferred sort of an economic blockade of Europe to starve out Germany, and they were looking at the Mediterranean as the place to attack Europe. So, again, his hypothesis is that they discussed this and perhaps agreed to both plans sort of as a trade-off. Anyway, we discussed that, and obviously World War II, D-Day, Manhattan Project, and so on. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Phil Paget, author of Advocating Overlord, The D-Day Strategy, and the Atomic Bomb. Thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you for calling. I look forward to it.
So tell me first, how did you get into writing and in writing on history?
Well, I'm not an historian. I'm a political scientist, and I had my career as a national security analyst. Way back when I was a teenager, there were two incidents within the space of about 20 minutes that set me on that course, and also made me aware of Franklin Roosevelt's trip up to a very remote area of Canada to go fishing in August 1943, and throughout my career working in support of various national security issues and negotiations, the memory of that would tug at me with why would he do that? Why at the height of the war, at a critical time in deciding the Allies' course to win the war in Europe, would he leave Washington and go off to go fishing? So when I got close to retirement, I started tracing that loose thread, and it led to some interesting places, which resulted in the book. So while I wrote in my career, and it was very important to write well and accurately about critical issues, history is new to me, but it was a case of following the evidence, and it led to some interesting places.
So this idea has sort of been tugging at you for many years then?
Many years.
And did you find information over time, or did you just sort of think about it, and then when you were ready, you really started investigating?
Well, I did find information over time, starting at the Roosevelt Library up in Hyde Park, where in the Secret Service records of trips of the president, they had a file on this trip. And looking at that and looking at the cables that went up to Roosevelt at that time from Washington and from London, started putting pieces together. And then in a local history corner of a store up there, I found a very interesting letter that was written by a young naval officer who had captained the cabin cruiser that Roosevelt called his fishing smack. And in the fifth paragraph of that letter, very short, he wrote, "And some of the most important things of this World War II happened, but of course I can't talk about that for a long time." Well, bingo.
Yeah.
So I Googled what were the two biggest secrets of that time. I Googled Normandy and the atomic bomb, just a shot in the dark, and up came a very interesting paper by a Canadian historian, Brian Loring Villa, in which he looked at the diplomatic history of the Manhattan Project, which had just been declassified then.
Mm-hmm.
This was back in 1977. He wrote his paper. And he looked at the links between these two separate negotiations, which drew ever closer. And he posited that there was a quid pro quo between Roosevelt and Churchill, in which Churchill reluctantly agreed to the strategy that would begin with the D-Day invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And in return, that night, Roosevelt signed a secret agreement with Churchill to reopen a cooperation on the bomb, which had been closed off to the British. Dr. Villa encouraged me, and I did. I went back and I retraced his research at the National Archives here in Washington, and also over at the British Archives in Kew, and found he was right, and I added to that, and that led to a good story. And there were separate stories. The book probably gives more emphasis to Overlord and that negotiation, which was a case of getting an agreement on the strategy while the strategy was being built.
Mm-hmm.
So, and all of that came to a head in August 1943 in a negotiation in Quebec called the Quadrant Conference, which the Americans considered to be a showdown event to get final commitment to a strategy for Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And it also bumped up against this atomic issue in a meeting between Roosevelt and Churchill just before the conference. And they ended up at that point, both leaders needed an agreement in writing. Roosevelt wanted Churchill to go first. So after they had met at Hyde Park, the generals and admirals agreed up in Quebec and signed on to Overlord as the dominant strategy in Europe. And that night, Churchill and Roosevelt signed a secret agreement on the atomic bomb.
Cooperation. So now you've told us some of the events that you discuss in the book, though obviously it's a big book, and it, you know, as I read through some of it, it goes through a lot of details about organizing both D-Day and something of the atomic
cooperation.
Sorry.
Yes, but by September of 1942, it became the Manhattan Project.
Right. So what is the focus of the book? You know, the precise focus, what were you getting at?
The repair of relations between the British and the Americans, which got down to the very basic point of trusting each other again to go forward with this strategy in the context of looking towards a relationship beyond the war, and cooperating on the atomic bomb and setting some limits on how they would approach its use. The agreement called for both sides to agree before they used it against anybody else. They wouldn't use them against each other, and they wouldn't share the information about atomic physics without each side agreeing.
So would you call this more, is this more of a diplomatic history, or is it more of a strategic or operational planning history of these?
It's a mix of the diplomacy and the operational planning that had to go into it. One thing that was very important to the debate on strategy was that it was easy for opponents to resist the idea of an invasion across the English Channel, so long as there wasn't a plan that both sides could agree to succeed. Once a plan was produced, that changed the debate from whether to go with the strategy to when to implement it and how to implement it. That was a very important change. When that point was reached, it happened that the American staffs back in Washington were having a crisis of confidence. And some of the original proponents of cross-channel invasion were beginning to say, well, maybe the British Mediterranean strategy is the bird in hand. Maybe we should go with that.
Hmm.
Now, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff were very committed to cross-channel attacks. So they were trying to counter what the official Army history calls, in subtitles, Revolt Against Overlord. Well, in London, the British chiefs of staff knew that was going on, and all of a sudden they had a viable plan for Overlord coming forward from an Allied staff led by a British general. And so the chief of the British staff, General Brooke, told the British general, General Morgan, well, go brief Churchill on his way over to North America, but don't give this plan to the Americans just yet.
Hmm.
So Morgan, who had an American deputy, was leading an Allied team, which was very well integrated and very committed to coming up with a successful plan. He went against his orders, and he sent a team from London to Washington with the Overlord plan, which is how Overlord got to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And it arrived, as the team reported back to General Morgan, quote, in the nick of time, close quote.
Ah. So what was the British aversion to a cross-channel invasion, or were they, did they just feel that Italy was just a better way to go?
Well, both countries came to the issue of how to approach winning the war in Europe from different points. That included their national history and their national circumstance. The British, of course, they're a maritime nation. They had that history, which led them towards the wars of attrition and blockade, and not having a strong partner on land in Europe. They lost that with France, and they didn't trust Russia. They wanted a war of attrition. They were strongly affected by how World War One had ended, in addition to an aversion of the trench warfare. The war ended when Germany suddenly collapsed internally, which no one had predicted. So they were led to a conclusion that through maritime blockade, aerial bombing, attacking all around the periphery of occupied Europe, they could induce the Reich to implode, and then they would take advantage of that, which both the Americans and the British called the opportunistic strategy.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans, on the other hand, wanted a direct military result. They wanted a quick war. They saw it, and the British certainly agreed. Germany was the most threatening enemy, so they wanted to win in Europe, pivot to the Pacific, beat the Japanese, and then come home.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't want to rely on the hope of economic political collapse. They wanted a direct result. And that was how they were, the words that they were using to express that to Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And within their own papers. So that was the source of the conflict between them. The British, of course, they saw operational ways that they could advance in various points in the Mediterranean, and they could see the benefit in that. And, you know, you could argue that point, but it was the larger issue of getting in quickly, striking into the German citadel and ending this,
mm-hmm.
and then moving on. And that was the argument that in the end prevailed. It was interesting that when General Morgan took over the planning for Overlord, he had to put that conflict to bed. So he told his staff directly that, you know, our orders are assume that we're going to do a direct assault. So that's the way we're going.
Mm-hmm.
So he got that, what was called the, quote, strategical question, out of the way, because that could easily create conflict between the different staffs.
Mm-hmm.
And so he focused on that basically American promoted idea of a direct assault.
So now, as far as atomic research, you know, the Manhattan Project, how, you know, it seems like Germany and the U.S. were both secretly looking to develop this, and obviously the U.K. knew that something was up. You know, how secretive was the fact that people were researching this? I understand it was, they kept the actual location secret, but as far as atomic bomb research, you know, what was going on there?
Well, that's a good question. It was kind of revealing. I had an eye out for that, just who knew and when did they know. It was quite secret. More so on the British side than on the American side. And maybe the most telling example of that is quite a number of the top U.S. generals knew that research to develop an atomic bomb was underway. The British Chiefs of Staff did not know that formally until July 1945 at the Potsdam Conference.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they may have been told informally, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no record that they were ever informed.
So as far as, so those, Germany and the, am I correct in saying that Germany was pursuing an atomic weapon, or I feel like I've read
they
that.
Were. They were pursuing that. Their research wasn't nearly as far along as the Allies thought it was. And the Allies became aware that they were ahead around March of 1945.
Mm-hmm.
But by that point, the project had its momentum.
Right.
It still had some very serious engineering challenges ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
And huge investment going into it from that point towards, well, until August.
Mm-hmm.
But it was rolling by then.
So now, so something you said, that the British chiefs of staff didn't know about the project until 1945, I think you said.
Right.
And, but Churchill and others were aware of it. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and that's interesting. Also, gets to who knew what when.
Mm-hmm.
Churchill knew, and he had his atomic staff who were developing what they called tube alloys, which was their code name for the project.
Mm-hmm.
And they communicated with each other quite well. They were pretty open with each other what was going on. In fact, Churchill was a micromanager, and it drove his generals to distraction. But it also meant he was telling people what he was doing,
mm-hmm.
at least within the circle that needed to know.
Mm-hmm.
Roosevelt, on the other hand, once said, I try to never let my left hand know what my right hand is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't quite so open with everybody. And he was a good delegator, which was important. But he didn't necessarily tell his atomic scientists and their managers everything that he was doing. So they developed a kind of different view of what a quid pro quo with the British would mean, which for the scientists was limited to an exchange of technical information, whereas the president, their boss, had a much wider horizon and was looking at a quid pro quo in terms of everything that needed to happen to win the war.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, ironically, the scientists didn't have a need to know about overlords. So,
right.
Roosevelt almost played what we today would call a good cop, bad cop routine, with Churchill, in which Roosevelt would never give up any of his capital with Churchill. He would always make positive but ambiguous statements about cooperating atomic research while his chief scientist, Vannevar Bush, was being the tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
And resisting all this. And when Roosevelt went off on his fishing trip, he had told Churchill, send your best man over. So Churchill had sent his head scientist to Washington. When he got there, he found he couldn't have any protocol reason to go talk to the President of the United States. The only person to talk to was Vannevar Bush,
mm-hmm.
who did indeed hold the line. So that 2 weeks later, when Roosevelt and Churchill met at Hyde Park, Churchill was expecting that Roosevelt would come around on strategy again as he had on the past. But Roosevelt didn't do that. And both men knew that the issue of cooperating on atomic research was still for them to be decided.
Hmm.
And Roosevelt held back a decision on that at Hyde Park. So Churchill left Hyde Park knowing that he still had to give an overlord in order to get atomic cooperation.
How, did anyone have any idea at this point what strategic value an atomic bomb would have, or did they have any idea of the extent of damage it could cause? You know, what were thoughts on this as a weapon?
They knew early on that it was tremendously powerful. The early estimates on both sides of the Atlantic were probably on the order of what we today we'd say 100 kilotons or so. Very powerful weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Not nearly as powerful as what would come. they were looking at a very powerful weapon. They were both, on both sides of the Atlantic, concerned about controlling that after the war and who would have access to it. They were beginning to speculate about a super bomb, to which the atomic bomb would just be a trigger. This years before Edward Teller came forward with that theory of Putin.
So they saw it as a world-changing weapon.
Like, they did.
Not just
but they also were thinking of it in terms of how all of the industrialized nations at that point were viewing air power and its influence, its strategic influence on warfare, which was much more political than operational military. And I dealt with this in the book. I had to deal with this up front because, you know, the air campaign and the U-boats are huge issues in their own right. But at the end of World War I, people came out believing that an industrialized society could compel to make government change its policy if they were bombed enough. Because both sides had been bombing at the end of World War I. And they went into World War II thinking that that would work. And it didn't work. But that's what they pursued. And even in, well, it would have been the end of July, last or early days of 45, when the targeting committee, which was Anglo-American, was meeting with General Groves in Washington, the political effect of the bomb was primary, and its military effect was secondary. And that's clearly stated in the record and in Groves' memoirs.
Did you come across, this may sound like somewhat of a silly question, but I've heard it said that that there was a Walt Disney film made during World War II called Victory Through Air Power, and the claim was made that Churchill saw it and was impressed by it and showed it and had Roosevelt look at it too, and that they both, it sort of swayed their opinions towards supporting more strategic bombing. Did you come across anything like that?
I'm not aware of that. But Churchill did do things to convince Roosevelt in the early days of the war, before the United States got in, convince him that British air power was having a good effect. There's a file in Hyde Park of photographs taken on the ground of a bomb-damaged aircraft factory in France that, you know, clearly some resistance agent took, which is marked very, very secret. But he shared that with Roosevelt because he wanted to convince them that bombing was having effect. And Roosevelt believed in bombing, too, because he didn't have an army to send. The only thing that they had was bombing. And as the army gets mobilized and trained and ready to deploy, you can see his position changing. Once he has an army to deploy and effect events, then his thinking about strategy is different.
Were any other what other nations were involved besides the U.S. and the U.K. in developing Overlord and discussing the atomic research?
Canada was quite involved in both. And actually, in the early plan for Overlord, the Canadian divisions were going to be at the center of the army that was landed on D-Day. And in fact, they did play a critical role that gets overlooked, which is unfortunate. If you've ever been to that area, the terrain between Bayeux and towards Cannes is really a broad plain, very good tank country, which slopes down to the sea. And the planners were very worried that the Germans would mount a panzer counteroffensive across that area. So they assigned the Canadian division to go there, and it was a tank and artillery heavy infantry division to hold the Germans off, which they did. And that's often underlooked. It gets people look at Canadian performance in trying to take Cannes, and they concentrate on that, but they need to look at how they stopped the panzers, which was very important between June 6th and June 10th, 1944.
Any other countries Were any other countries major players, or?
I don't know that anyone else was. Well, of course, the French resistance mattered a lot.
Right, right, yes.
Getting information. The South Africans get mentioned, but I don't think they had a major role. I think they provided some expertise.
So,
but there wasn't a lot of expertise. At the time they started planning this, generally, military opinion around the world was against the idea of a seaborne amphibious assault. This wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in the war, the only major landing that had been against North Africa, and the view of the American generals and admirals and their British counterparts was that the Americans had succeeded against light resistance by luck.
Mm.
So there was a lot of opinion against this working. There were no capabilities, so they had to make a steep learning curve to come up with a workable plan while building the wherewithal to implement it.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm getting at ultimately is, were the Soviets at all involved in any of these discussions, at least as far as, hey, just so you know, this is what's going on with the Western Front?
They were involved to launch an offensive on the Eastern Front, time to help divert pressure from Overlord.
Mm-hmm.
They were involved to that extent.
Okay.
And that was important.
But as far as an idea of an atomic bomb, they were probably not at all informed, or?
Not by the Allies.
Right.
Intentionally.
Right, right.
They had their own effort going, and they had their espionage agents at work.
Oh, so the Soviets were pursuing an atomic bomb, too?
Or? They were, but they came to it later. Stalin needed to be convinced that this was important, and once he was, they certainly had both the intellectual and industrial resources to make it work.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess eventually they got the information in another way after the war.
Well, they did, and also, you know, you can't underrate Soviet science. It's very good.
Right, right. Okay. Are there any other secondary issues you explored in the book that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, I think that the struggle in reestablishing trust was important. People asked me what surprised me most about the book, and it wasn't in the book, but in the environment in which it was written. When I started this, around late 2009, early 2010. You know, the institutions that got their start in World War II and were built up later, the NATO and the international cooperation on economics and things like that, were pretty solid. And by the time the book went to press in 2017, all of that is really under challenge again. On both sides of the Atlantic, from ethno-nationalism and what's beginning to be called authoritarian populism.
Mm-hmm.
And what I got from the book was it's a cautionary tale that if you break relationships with countries and allow suspicion and resentment to come into this, you can't turn that around on a dime. Mm-hmm. Even when you're facing an existential threat. And there were the Americans and the Brits really struggling throughout 1943 in order to come to the point where, as they finally said to each other, our problem is we don't trust each other.
Hmm.
And once they started to trust each other, then things started to come together. And I hope that people will take from this that it's important not to let relationships atrophy in the absence of an immediate threat, because when it does come, you may not be able to catch up.
Right. Okay, so you mentioned some of the resources you used to do your research. Can you talk about more of some of the primary resources you used?
Okay, well, very important is that the positing a link, a quid pro quo link, between Overlord and the atomic research, that's a controversial idea. And the evidence for it is circumstantial. But it's very extensive. So I was careful in using primary documents wherever I could.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot are out of the National Archives and Records Administration here in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I also looked at the corresponding records at the British National Archives. to build that story. So lots of primary documents, the established histories and the memoirs of the principals. I really stood on the shoulders of that generation of historians who had, were fortunate enough to talk to the principals while they were alive. And then comparing and looking for, you know, what's validated. So it's, it, I have, you know, I can tell you there are 1,000 endnotes in the book.
No.
And I know that number because my publisher made me go back and reformat every one of them.
Were there any interesting artifacts or objects or historic documents that really stood out that you found in while doing your research?
Well, there were a few. On the fishing trip, all of the principals up there signed the navigation chart as a souvenir. So it's very interesting to see Roosevelt and all of his close advisors, plus the railroad representatives and the young officers who were captaining the boat on this chart there. And in there, later on, they all look back on that trip fondly. It's a happy time. That was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But the things that affect me, and I think affect all historians, if I could, you know, dare to say I am one, is every once in a while you hold something in your hands that takes you right to the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in London, I was looking at Churchill's papers, and I saw this memoranda that had gone to him, and there's this little dark brown spot in the margin. And I looked really closely at that, and I asked the woman next to me, and she looked at it, and it was a scorch from a cigar ember. And when you got that, you know, yeah, you know, these people were real.
Yeah.
And also, the very first time I went to do research, I went to Georgetown University, which has a lot of Harry Hopkins papers, and it was long before I was holding his diplomatic passport. And the picture in that is as crisp and fresh as if it had been taken and printed yesterday. And I'm holding that and thinking, well, this was in his breast pocket when he met Churchill for the first time, 1940, but nothing was certain. And a year later, when he met Stalin, and nothing was certain. And you don't need too many experiences like that to convince you that, you know, history is a living thing. It's,
Yeah.
It's worth conserving.
Yeah, definitely. So, what part of the research was most enjoyable?
Getting out and kicking the tires. Being up in Canada at the site where they went fishing, an area which I know well, getting into the Churchill War Rooms and going to Hyde Park, and one that I still have ahead of me is I'll be giving a talk aboard the now 106-year-old battleship Texas in August. And the book in the prologue and again in the epilogue uses the Texas's war diary because it had an important role in D-Day. And I think it's wonderful that you can still go to a place like that and stand on that deck and know, D-Day, this was there. Never mind the SUV parked out in the lot, you know. When you're on there, you're at D-Day.
So you said the war diary?
Yes. Yes.
What is that? I'm not familiar with the...
In the National Archives and Records Administration has all of the war diaries and decalogues and action reports of naval vessels.
Okay.
Which are wonderful to research.
So that's separate from the ship's log, then, the war diary?
Well, a ship's decalogue, it's not always called that, but it's called that or a action report or something.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
What did you find most surprising in your research?
I shouldn't have been surprised by this, but the influence of World War One was great. Both the British and the Americans, to an extent, were, in a sense, fighting the last war.
So
that came in strongly with respect to air power.
Mm-hmm.
And the the fear of repeating the trench warfare. General Brooke, the top British general, after the war, said he didn't believe that Churchill understood mid-20th century warfare. He thought that he really only understood warfare in terms of World War I. And that couldn't help but affect people's thinking about what they wanted to do.
That brings up a question I wanted to ask earlier, which is, with all this planning for D-Day, you know, you often hear the story, sort of like, you know, they got lucky that the weather broke when they actually went ahead and you know, conducted the invasion, and that they were able to have air power, air support.
Yep.
You know, it seems to me that, you know, if there must have been a plan B or a plan, you know, a contingency plan if things didn't go well. You know, what did you come across as far as that goes?
I didn't find a contingency plan. Had they failed on June 6, 1944, it would have had a real problem. It might have been that the only thing they could have done at that point was to pursue a Mediterranean strategy, which led to post-war Europe very different from what we experienced.
Mm-hmm.
The Cossack team, which did the planning, they had looked carefully at the European coast, and like everyone else, they quickly focused down on Normandy and the Pas-de-Calais as two places to go.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their reasons for choosing Normandy over the Pas-de-Calais. But if it hadn't worked, I'm not sure what they could have done. A threat did develop at the end of 1943, which is underappreciated and underrecognized. Within the United States, the non-operating railroad unions were threatening to strike because they did not receive overtime, although they were working as hard as everybody else. And everybody was sympathetic with their situation, but they couldn't allow wildcat strikes, which had started in steel and coal. So that, you had the railroads struck in the United States, that would have affected the war effort worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the United States was surging over a million troops across the Atlantic to Britain, and doing it within 8 months, because the troops had to marry up with their equipment and get trained for the invasion, and the British ports would have to turn to loading ships for D-Day. So it was very important to do this on schedule, plus the movement of the millions of tons of supplies and the effects everywhere else in the world. The concern was so great that General Marshall later said that he considered resigning over this issue.
Hmm.
His estimate was that had the strike happened, D-Day would have been delayed by 6 months, because the window for good weather in the Channel would have closed, and it would have gone into 1945. And I think he was optimistic, because the Allies wouldn't have been able to keep the operational secret that long.
Mm-hmm.
They were already in a race with the Germans, who were reinforcing in the Normandy area.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have imposed at least a year's delay, and it would have been much harder.
So another question comes to mind, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with the book by Acheson, Present at the Creation. So, and when I read through that, I was just struck by how much just general worldwide economic considerations affected war planning, you know, apart from,
yes,
you know, needs of the War Department.
Yes.
How much was the State Department involved in everything you're mentioning?
Roosevelt was pretty much his own Secretary of State on a lot of this. The State Department was involved on a lot of the important things at a slightly lower level, and the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, weighed in at important points. Just before the Tehran Conference in November of 1943, there was a Moscow meeting of foreign ministers that Cordell Hull went to, and they laid a lot of groundwork for what was covered at Tehran. And the economic considerations, of very much were a factor. The British people were literally living hand-to-mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so the British had appealed for more shipping to bring essential goods to Britain so that they could continue. And the U.S. Army pushed back on that, but they had to be overruled.
Hmm.
So they had you had to keep food flowing to keep people alive in the British Isles. As the Allies liberated areas that had been under occupation, it was necessary to provide essential foods and medicines and things to people who were really suffering.
Hmm.
In North Africa, and then in Sicily, and in Italy, and then later on in France, and it's beyond this book, but Eisenhower resisted liberating Paris in part because it would require the diversion of a lot of logistics effort, which would have been needed to support the advancing troops.
Hmm.
So those kinds of issues were very much a factor.
And you're saying the Department of State was more of what they were involved with, like organizing that sort of stuff?
They were involved on diplomatic relations between all the different countries of the world with their day-to-day function.
Right.
And a lot of side conversations that affect after the war on tariffs and trade, on air rights, things like that were happening. And that was important in terms of how the post-war world would look. And it was having an effect on the British Empire, which, of course, Churchill was very aware of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what was the most difficult part to research? Either a question that you still feel like you haven't gotten a strong answer on, or something you did achieve, but it just took a lot of effort?
I think I've been pretty fortunate in how this has come together. It's still the idea of the quid pro quo is still based pretty much on circumstantial evidence, except for one letter which Churchill wrote to Roosevelt on the train after he left Hyde Park to go back to Quebec. I've been fortunate in the documents are there and people make them accessible. Other historians have been very helpful to me over time to move this forward.
So about this quid pro quo idea, do you think there's something out there that, if discovered, could really strengthen your argument, give it a lot stronger support, or, do you see something out there that you could find in the future, maybe?
Well, I don't think so, because Roosevelt died, and of course never wrote a memoir,
mm-hmm.
and he was against keeping records anyway.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the records of his administration, that comes from other people. There's not that much from him except the letters that he wrote to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so something that I think would help everybody across the board would be the transcripts of the telephone conversations between Roosevelt and Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans succeeded in breaking the encrypted telephone line that Roosevelt and Churchill used. And they were able to intercept and access every one of those calls from November 1940 to the middle of July 1943.
Mm-hmm.
A young German radio engineer thought he could break the system, which was used in 1920s technology. He succeeded. They set him up in a commandeered youth hostel on the Dutch coast. There was one frequency on which this radio telephone was broadcast, and they got it all. Now, his team made some mistakes in translation. So the Gestapo said, okay, well, you send the raw transcripts to us, and we'll do the translation in Berlin,
mm-hmm.
which they did. And all of those transcripts are said to have been destroyed in the bombing of Berlin.
Hmm.
If anybody can find those transcripts, that would be a gold mine for a historian.
Huh, yeah, that would be nice. So apart from actually being at the lake you mentioned, was there anything that you discovered that emotionally moved you in some way, either positively or negatively, you know, made you sad or happy in some way?
Well, it was interesting that Roosevelt was very evasive on things, and into August, his position on Overlord was very uncertain. Marshall and the other joint chiefs were really not confident that Roosevelt was in their corner. But they had a meeting at the White House in which Roosevelt really gave direction. And when a president does that, any president, mm-hmm. I mean, even reading the stale papers, the recording that, there's an electricity to it that comes forward. And that moved me. After studying all of the indecision and debate and everything, suddenly here's clarity and a direction forward. And that was exciting.
So you mentioned something of what you hope the book will do as far as getting people to understand the importance of maintaining international relationships. So with that in mind, is there something else, or what do you hope the book will do in general?
Well, if it will do that, that would be wonderful, if even in a small way. Mm-hmm. And when I set out, my goal then is still true today. I've gotten the discussion of the possible link between the atomic bomb operation and Overlord. That's there now to be discussed, well documented from circumstantial evidence. So I think it's added another brick to our understanding of those times. Mm-hmm. And if it does that, I'll be happy.
Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published and how you overcame them?
Well, I got a good agent, and he put it out for me. It took a couple of months. We got some tickles of interest, and then University of Nebraska Press really wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. So that was important. An agent is a valuable thing to have. Mm-hmm. Doing this on your own is hard, and self-publishing is harder still.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's good to have an agent and a publisher.
So I think from the dates you had given me as far as when you were working on this, did the project span, sounds like it spanned maybe 7 years or more, is that correct, or did I?
Well, it was 8 going on 9 years.
Okay.
Which is not too unusual.
Mm-hmm. So that involved...
I wasn't doing this full time, so...
Oh, okay. Do you have, what's your next writing project, if there is one?
There may be another one, and I can't begin to get my head around that yet.
Okay. Is there some place people can find your work, apart from Amazon and the press itself?
It's out in the independent bookstores and in the Barnes & Noble chain.
Mm-hmm.
The book's out there.
Do you have your own personal website or any social media for?
I do. Okay. I do. I have a website for the book.
Mm-hmm.
And my agent is fond of that I'll write another book and use my name for the website instead of advocating Overlord.
Oh, okay.
So the website is www.philpadget.com.
Okay. And does that have, because you said you've done quite a bit of writing professionally throughout your career, is any of that on there, or is it focused on the book right now?
No, unfortunately, almost all of that was either classified or proprietary, so...
Oh, okay, okay.
You know, God. And they never come back and tell you 20 years later, it's okay, you can say that.
Yeah. Okay, so that's how...
The website does have a lot of frequently asked questions and goes into some of the details behind some of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be adding to it.
You're going to add to the 1,000 footnotes you already have in the book?
Not to the footnotes, but on the website. Now, there are photographs that didn't make it into the book, which we can click on the website.
Oh, okay. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
Well, no. It's a privilege and an honor to be able to research this, and you feel a kinship with the people 75 years ago who risked it all so we can enjoy life today.
Yeah, I think
I'm ever more grateful to them.
Yeah, I think people forget the amount of sacrifice both on the front and also on the home front. And thankfully, yes, people, you know, for that sacrifice, people don't have to suffer through it again. At least they haven't for a long while.
No.
So, yeah, so I definitely agree. All right, well, thank you for speaking with me.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please like or follow me on Facebook under warscholar.org, on Twitter under warscholar, on Instagram under Chris Alvarez Warscholar, on YouTube under warscholar1945. More information can be found at warscholar.org. Thank you.